This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the renewable energy advocate, Randy Swisher. He was the executive director of the American Wind Energy Association for 20 years, up until last year, actually, and he's still a senior advisor for them. Randy Swisher, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks very much, Matt. It's great being with you.
Well, no, the pleasure's mine, and I'm interested in this field, and I haven't known but terribly much about it. You know, us journalists were a mile long and a half inch deep, so that's about how I've been on wind energy, and I hope to learn more. I already have learned a little bit in preparing for this. And in my preparation, I saw that you were one of those Nader Raiders back in the 70s. How'd you get involved in that? What was that like?
It was really, I went to Nader's organization with a proposal to work for them for 6 months as a participant observer to write a dissertation. And they said, sure, come on along. Well, the 6 months turned into 6 years, but that was both how I became a renewable energy advocate through working for what was called DC Public Interest Research Group, and it really helped me to find my passion, which is advocacy. And it's been great. No complaints. I've had a good time.
And you, over the years, you've testified before Congress several times. Is that intimidating?
Not as much as you might expect. You know, they're there for a reason. They're asking you there because they're interested in what you have to say. And so if you have an agenda, if there's something that you're trying to make happen in the world, that's one venue that it's valuable to be there.
And the people who are the legislators who oppose your agenda, do they prepare nasty questions or do they let you go?
You know, one thing about renewable energy is you don't have that many people who are out there in an outspoken way trying to get in your way. There's certainly people. There's a rising tide of opposition that we're seeing from some in the fossil fuel industry.
That's what I was going to say. I would think the oil industry toadies on Capitol Hill would prepare a barrage for you.
Well, you know, I don't think they took it that seriously for a long time. Now that wind is providing 40% of all the new electricity that was added in our country last year and the year before.
Wow, that's a lot. I don't think people realize that.
I know that's the case. People don't realize how real this industry is today. But some of the fossil fuel interests are starting to wake up to that, and they're starting to systematically go after the wind industry. So
they recognize it as a threat.
They seem to.
Mm-hmm. And you believe that, how much of the electricity consumed in the United States can be provided by wind energy?
Today, it's only about 2%, mm-hmm. but the wind industry has been doubling every 3 years for the last decade, and I don't see that growth slowing down anytime soon. 39% per year on average for the last 5 years. So it's been dramatic, and it's been fun to be in the center of and watch this happen. I started with the wind industry in 1989, and there wasn't a lot there at that point. It was not a real industry.
And it mostly was a dream.
Well, that's true. It's a vision that a lot of people shared going back to the, you know, certainly the early 70s when we experienced that first Arab oil embargo, and a lot of people began to realize, to sort of think strategically about the value that renewable energy could have to our both the economy and the environment. And there were a lot of people that were renewable energy visionaries in the 1970s. The technologies weren't really ready for prime time at that point.
Are they ready now?
They are. They are. We've seen dramatic changes in both the cost effectiveness of technologies like wind and solar and how well they work. So, yeah, I think that's part of the message is renewable energy is ready for prime time, and we need to start thinking and acting in a serious way about bringing these technologies to the center of our whole energy economy.
I mean, one thing that I found out in reading some of the material for this was that it's so easy and so quick to get some of those wind turbines up. It's not like you got to build for 10 years or something.
Absolutely. You can do wind in a very modular way, the same way that you can with solar. You can add capacity in small, medium, or large increments and do it fairly quickly. So that's part of the reason why wind has grown so dramatically in recent years, is that there's not a lot of risk for the electric utility. And that's part of what they're all about, is evaluating their options and going with the option that is least risk, both, you know, in terms of the cost, but also other factors. That's why you haven't seen, I mean, there's been more wind going on the system in the last 5 years than there has been coal, for understandable reasons, and certainly more than nuclear. We haven't had a new nuclear plant in this country for over 30 years. But that's why wind is doing so well. Not a lot of risk.
On nuclear, I'm just surprised, I guess I shouldn't be, that Obama's pushing nuclear so hard. Why do you think that is?
I think he cares about getting a climate bill done. And what that means, to get it done, you have to do it on a bipartisan basis. And the Republicans care about nuclear. I don't think this is something that's, you know, in the heart and soul of Barack Obama, but he knows if he's going to get an energy bill done, he has got to compromise with the Republicans. To me, that raises some fundamental questions, but that is really what's going on here.
And if you'd compare the two, the wind energy industry and the nuclear energy industry, give us the pluses and minuses.
Well, I think there are really two competing visions for the future. There is a renewable energy or a sustainable energy vision, which means maximizing the wind and the sun and the energy efficiency. And there's a nuclear vision. And it's not clear to me. Matter of fact, I would say those two visions are not compatible. The capital requirements of moving strongly towards nuclear are overwhelming. Nuclear plants are about $10 billion a pop. And the other thing is, operationally, nuclear and wind and solar aren't very compatible. If you're going to maximize renewables on the system, you want a lot of flexibility to handle the variability of wind and solar. So that means things like, you know, pairing them with natural gas, which is very flexible operationally. But nukes are clunky. You know, you can't run them up and down very easily. They have to run all the time. So, I think you have to choose. Do you support a renewable energy vision, or do you support a nuclear vision?
And the nuclear vision would not be able to materialize were it not for the government's guarantees, loan guarantees, and also liability guarantees.
No one privately, no private investor has been willing to finance a nuclear plant in over three decades. And nobody is lining up to do it today without federal loan guarantees. So, I mean, to me, that's a pretty profound message about the viability of nuclear as an option.
And then there's the disaster question and the nuclear waste question, which aren't easy to dismiss either. Are people lining up to invest in wind?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, it's been remarkable to watch the cost of money for people that are borrowing to do wind projects has gone down dramatically over the last decade. There's really been a rush of investment in what we call the new energy economy, because I think smart people recognize this is where the world is going.
Speaking with Randy Swisher, he's the executive, former 20-year executive director of the American Wind Energy Association. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. What can the government do to push us toward this renewable energy vision that you've been articulating?
I'm happy to say that the Obama administration has been working very hard to help make a reality of this vision. There are a number of things you can look at specifically that they've done. You look at the Recovery Act. They are investing billions of dollars, over almost $17 billion in both renewable energy and energy efficiency as part of the Recovery Act. And these are investments in things like a major blade testing facility in Boston that will dramatically improve the ability of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory to work with the private sector in designing the best wind turbine blades in the world. You know, that's just an example. But I think the other piece that I'm very excited about is that the National Renewable Energy Lab today is working on an analysis of the feasibility of renewable energy providing 80% of our nation's electricity by the year 2050.
And that's a figure I hadn't seen. I saw a DOE report, Department of Energy report, that said 20% by 2030.
20% wind by 2030.
Okay.
And sort of the natural follow-up is if wind can do that much, and it's clear that that is very feasible, then how much can we achieve using all of the renewables? And this analysis by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, I think, the wind analysis, the 20% wind analysis, provided a blueprint for how to get there. If you understand the barriers to achieving 20% wind, you can design a strategy for systematically going after each of those barriers. The same thing, I think, is true for the broader renewable energy question.
What are some of those biggest barriers?
Well, on the wind side, you start with the fact that this country has never had long-term, stable policy to support moving in this direction. It's been a series of short-term incentives that have driven people thinking about investing in this area crazy. And that's part of the reason why we have never been able to build a very vibrant manufacturing base for wind or solar. You see most manufacturing for these technologies taking place in Europe because the Europeans understood and strategically put together a series of policies that have driven long-term investment, and today they dominate manufacturing in both wind and solar. I'm hoping that we now understand what's at stake, that this is where the energy industry is going. And if we want to capture the manufacturing jobs that we know are there, there are a few simple things we have to do. One is putting policy in place that'll make clear to investors that there's a home here.
What are some of those economic benefits that you're referring to?
You can look multiple areas. One of the most exciting today, given what we see happening in our economy, is recognizing that this industry, which is growing by leaps and bounds, inevitably involves thousands, many thousands of manufacturing jobs. We have a manufacturing infrastructure in this country that we've been bleeding to death. And, the renewable energy industries, energy efficiency, represents that is the future. That's where we're going. These wind turbines will be manufactured somewhere. Why not have them manufactured here in Wisconsin, other communities within the Great Lakes region? We have a manufacturing infrastructure. We have skilled people that are looking for ways of using those skills. And each wind turbine includes 8,000 components. Hmm. Every one of those components has got to be manufactured somewhere.
And these plants are empty right now, and these workers are out of work.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've seen a real rush of companies around the world. Now that the U.S. is the world's largest market for wind turbines, manufacturers all over the world want to participate in that market. They're looking to set up domestic supply chains here in the U.S., but the more we have long-term policy to give them assurances, the more investment we'll see.
And I see there's that one plant in Iowa that used to manufacture Maytags and now is doing wind turbines.
Exactly.
And so that's kind of a model. I'm speaking of Randy Swisher. He's the former executive director, long time, of the American Wind Energy Association, and you're listening to Progressive Radio. The number of jobs, so you have to have people who manufacture these turbines, and you have to have people who put them up to install them. So what is the job picture if you get to 20% by 2030? How many people are going to be employed?
Yeah, the analysis that the Department of Energy did showed that when you look at the manufacturing jobs, the construction jobs, and the operations jobs, you're talking about roughly 500,000 jobs by the year 2030. And that's just one technology. So if you multiply that by all the jobs that we have in energy efficiency, by all the jobs we have in solar and geothermal and biomass, you're talking about millions of green-collar jobs. Let's go out and get them.
One way we can go out and get them is to have the federal government and state governments, for that matter, contract with wind farms to get some of their electricity from wind. Or, for instance, the Pentagon, for instance, has got bases all over the country. They are doing some stuff on solar, I know, which is pretty forward, especially for the Pentagon. Are they doing wind also?
They are. But it's, you know, it's slow progress. Working with the government can take a lot of time. But there seems to be a real interest on the part of many federal agencies in moving this direction. But it does take time. I think the most important thing that the government could do to move in this direction, one would be there are a number of different courses. They can make long-term tax credits available as opposed to these short-term things that we've seen over the past decade. They could provide a federal renewable energy standard similar to what more than 30 states have done across this country, setting a minimum expectation for the utilities in this country about having a certain percentage of their electricity come from renewable energy by a certain time. Or they could put a price on carbon, which is something there's been a lot of debate about. But, you know, if we're serious about dealing with climate, and we need to be, we have got to do something to put a price on carbon emissions.
Well, let's talk about how wind can replace carbon. I believe I read that if we get to that 2030 goal of 20% wind, carbon from electricity would be reduced by as much as 25%, and just an astonishing number of gallons of water would be saved too.
Exactly. It would be it's remarkable to think that this one technology has the ability to basically flatline the projected emissions from the electric utility sector between now and 2030 if we move aggressively in this way, in this direction. But that is the reality that this analysis demonstrated. So it's we're not talking about a trivial kind of contribution.
What is the reaction you get from private utilities? I have a friend I play basketball with who works at the local utility here, and I would talk to him in the locker room about solar, wind, and his initial response was, well, it's just not feasible. Do you get that from other utility people, or are they coming around?
Well, I'm pleased to say that electric utilities are moving in the right direction, but by nature, they are fairly conservative institutions. They are not risk takers. They are not innovators when it comes to new technology. And that's part of the reason why these mandates for utilities have been so important. It really has required utilities to adopt these new technologies. And once that happens, you know, they actually learn that, number one, they don't cost as much as they fear. They operate better than they expect. So, and that this crazy wind stuff and this crazy solar stuff can actually be integrated in with the rest of their mix much more easily than they anticipated. So the utility industry is changing, and we're seeing a dramatic interest in utilities actually owning these wind projects for the first time, not just simply purchasing the power.
So they would own a wind farm?
Well, they do. A growing number of utilities like MidAmerican, the utility that Warren Buffett owns, is now the largest private utility owning wind turbines across the country. And, the way Warren Buffett goes tends to be the direction that a lot of other smart investors follow.
I was going to say that's a pretty big endorsement. And also, the other big investor that we heard about was T. Boone Pickens. Is he still pushing wind?
T. Boone is still out there. He's bought a bunch of wind turbines, and he intends to get them deployed over the next year or so. So, T. Boone is a guy who's made a lot of money and tends to again, be a pretty smart investor. He knows natural gas very well, as you know. He understands that wind and gas work together quite well. So I'm always pleased to have somebody like T. Boone stand up and say wind is the way to go.
You were the executive director of the American Wind Energy Association, Randy Swisher, when he came out publicly for that and spent millions of dollars on advertising. That must have been like money in the street.
Yeah, it was like, manna from heaven. And, his message, I mean, everywhere I went around the country, I found people, having more of a familiarity with wind than they'd ever had, simply because he was buying all that airtime.
What about states? How are the states moving? And what are the states that are biggest in wind power, both actual and potential, I guess?
Well, one of the problems we've had on the federal level is getting things done, particularly in terms of the environment. And so given the relative lack of leadership from Washington for many years, having the states taking the lead on renewable energy has been just invaluable. And we've seen some interesting things. It's not just, I mean, California was the early lead back in the 1980s, but the state that's made the most progress in the last few decades since then is the state of Texas.
The big oil state.
Exactly. And you know, that's not coincidental. Texas has an identity as an energy state, and as their oil and gas resources have depleted, as they became aware of the fact they've got this great wind resource, you know, they don't really want to move towards being an energy importing state. So they're working very hard at developing their wind resource and doing a darn good job of it.
What are a couple of the other big states as far as wind production?
Number two is Iowa, my original home state, which I'm very proud of. And, you know, again, Iowa is not the windiest state in the country. That's really a reflection of good policy and a lot of strong leadership from the governor, from the state legislature, from you know, Senator Chuck Grassley in the U.S. Senate. You know, so it's a lot of different people who've contributed to that. But it has pleased me to no end to see states like Iowa and Minnesota step in and really make some things happen.
And the Dakotas and Montana, you'd think they'd be prime targets too.
Well, they're prime targets in terms of the wind resource. The Dakotas rank right up there near the top. But there aren't a lot of people. And today we don't have the transmission necessary to get that energy from where the wind power is to where the major population centers in this country are. So if we ever want to harness the wind potential that this country has, one of the things we will need is what we call green power superhighways to get that power from the Great Plains to the major metropolitan
areas.
So this is
a grid question, but it also could be another answer to the unemployment problem in this country.
Absolutely.
Think how many people you'd have to employ to get a new grid or a modern grid up.
Well, it isn't as much as you might expect. You know, we're talking about a relatively few lines, sort of backbone transmission lines that could get a lot of that energy from the Great Plains to places like Chicago or the West Coast or the East Coast. And the capital investment, while it may sound daunting at, you know, I think it's something like $75 billion to do a transmission grid that would be sufficient to basically fulfill the 20% wind ambition. That sounds like a lot of money. But when you realize you're talking about a $2 trillion capital investment that this country will have to make over the next few decades simply to meet its future electricity needs, you know, the transmission investment will pay for itself in no time. And Texas is really a good example of that. They're investing $5 billion in transmission to access the wind resources in West Texas. It's projected by the State Public Utility Commission that that'll pay for itself in reduced energy costs in about 3 years.
Randy Swisher, what about the potential for offshore wind farms?
There's no question that there's enormous potential offshore, particularly the northeast coast from Maine to North Carolina. Lots of wind there. It is more expensive just because the infrastructure is more expensive. And I think for that reason, it'll take longer to develop that resource. But I think inevitably over time, that'll become an increasingly strong contributor. You've got offshore wind in Europe now. So I think it's just a question of time before it comes to the U.S.
And are there environmental issues with offshore?
You know, there is a project that has been proposed called Cape Wind off the Massachusetts coast. And for the last 7 years, a guy named Jim Gordon has been trying to get that project built. He has had something like 5,000 pages of environmental impact statement prepared analyzing that project. And it's very clear from that analysis that there is no significant environmental impact associated with that project. What he is facing is the opposition of some very wealthy Cape Cod landowners, some fossil fuel interests and mining interests that don't want to look at a wind farm 6 miles off the coast, even though it'll be, you know, almost invisible. But that's an example of some of the opposition that you can encounter in a few resort communities like Cape Cod.
That it's an eyesore.
Well, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. Yeah. But I happen to think these wind turbines are beautiful. But.
Now, you know, I'm a bird watcher. On our walk over here, we were lucky to see a peregrine falcon, actually two of them. In the birding community, there's a question about wind farms because there are reports of birds flying into these wind turbines and dying. How serious a problem is that?
Well, it's certainly an issue that has gotten the very strong attention of the wind industry. I'm happy to say that the National Audubon Society supports the 20% wind vision because they are deeply concerned about the problem of climate change and the impact that climate change is having and will have on bird species. You know, they've worked with us. You know, they support 20% wind if the wind industry is willing to work with them to ensure the proper siting of these projects and that we're doing everything we can to minimize the impact of wind turbines on birds. And I'm happy to say that something has been established called the American Wind Wildlife Institute that is really a partnership between nonprofit groups like Audubon and other environmental advocates and the wind industry that is intended to work together to understand those impacts on birds and to do everything we can to advance the science and to minimize the impact of wind turbines on birds.
Speaking with Randy Swisher, as the former executive director of the American Wind Energy Association, I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Tell me about the global prospects for wind energy, and to what extent can wind help not just the United States, but the entire world, and maybe even especially the third world, find some energy answers?
I was in Beijing a year and a half ago and attended the Global Wind Energy Conference in Beijing. It was remarkable to see the way the Chinese are getting engaged with this technology. Last year, in fact, they installed more wind turbines than any other country in the world, and they clearly intend to have wind be a major contributor and for them to be a major player in the global wind industry. It's, you know, there are all kinds of manufacturing companies, all kinds of, you know, I was at this conference with literally hundreds of Chinese companies that were exhibiting their products. So it was quite an eye-opener to see that. There's also a very strong wind industry in India. Europe is where, you know, most of the wind industry was born through the 1990s. A lot of the manufacturing companies were established there in the 1990s. So at this point, you really have sort of three different areas of focus in the global market: Europe, North America, and Asia. And yet very rapid growth and interest in Latin America, Africa, all over the world. So, we've seen it grow gradually from one continent to another, but I think it's very clear that the wind will be contributing on a global basis.
Randy Swisher, we just have about 30 seconds left. What can individuals do who want to promote this switch over to wind?
You know, I think the most important thing is supporting strong policy at both the federal and state level, a federal and state renewable energy standard, and you know, talking to your local utility and urging them to embrace renewable energy to the greatest extent possible.
Well, it's been very interesting speaking with you, Randy. I appreciate you being on the show.
I appreciate the opportunity, Matt. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.